How's that for a blast from the past? Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Sukkot in the year 5767, and this is different from the shows that we've done till now for the last significant piece of time. This is actually live, if you're listening to it now. Of course, if you're listening to it archived, it will have been recorded already. But if you're actually listening now at 5 after 5 p.m. Israel time, remember that we've changed the clock back to winter time. If you're listening in the States, you haven't yet changed it back. So we are 6 hours different rather than 7 hours. Figure out what that makes it where you are. In any event, this will have a different flavor to it, thanks to a computer failure that I had earlier in the week. Actually, Erev Yom Kippur, I tried running the computer, and it went. And I just got it back today, and it's not ready for recording and internet transmission, etc., etc. So the people at the A7 studio are nice enough to decide to do the show by telephone. So that's the story. But let's get into Sukkot preparation. Before that, as we usually do, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tehiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai miya amod, ki imecha haslicha lema'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem viyotziyem, mitzara lirvacha umeyafela leora, umishibud legeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Every time we say that little piece that follows Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130, this is the piece from the regular prayer book, and it asks God to address the issue of Jews in trouble anywhere they might be. The most recent people that come to mind are the kidnapped soldiers, whose return we still eagerly await and pray for. And the people not so recent. Added to that and considered a captive, just like any soldier who would have been captured in battle, is Jonathan Pollard, and the prayers for the release of those who stand in trouble certainly include him, whether we mention it or not. Okay, let's turn to Sukkot and see where that takes us. I sort of have this, wouldn't call it necessarily a block, but a fixation almost on the situation, which is not very rare, but also not every year, that Shabbat is the first day of Sukkot. 2 weeks ago, we had Rosh Hashanah on Shabbat, and it was unusual in the fact that we don't blow shofar. I still remember fondly the man I found standing in the back of the shul on that first, that must have been 3-4 years ago when we had it, standing in the back of the shul, and he's just got his hands in his pocket, and he's waiting patiently, and I go over to him, and I offer him a machzor to daven from, and he's not really interested, and he doesn't know how, and I offered him a seat, and he said he was fine standing there. And then it dawned on me that he's waiting for something that he wasn't going to get that day, and that was shofar, and when I told him, he was in shock. Anyway, let's leave shofar 2 weeks ago, but let's talk the same thing with Lulav and Etrog. And I want to get it across of how unusual, better word, how noteworthy, remarkable, in the literal sense of those words, the situation is. The Torah says, that on the 15th day of the 7th month, which is Tishrei, we begin celebrating the holiday of Sukkot. The first day is Kodesh, meaning it's a festival with restrictions of various activities that you're not allowed to do on that day. It is a sacred day, and that is followed by the remaining 6 days of Sukkot, which are called Chol HaMoed. They are not sacred on that level of prohibition of Malacha, but they do have certain restrictions, and they do have a certain sanctity of a lesser type. And then the 8th day, which we call in Israel Simchat Torah, in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, that day is really 2 days, the 8th and the 9th day, if you start counting from this Shabbat. And the 8th day is called Shmini Atzeret, and the 9th day is called Simchat Torah. Here, basically, we call the day Shmini Atzeret also, especially within the prayer, but it is referred to by its more common name of Simchat Torah. So even though it looks like we have fused the 2 days of Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah into one, it is really in Chutz La'aretz that those 2 days have been separated, and they belong together. In any event, let's hold that off for next week. Let's talk Sukkot. So you have the Torah statement that on the first day of Sukkot, we are commanded to take the 4 species, the fruit of a goodly tree, pre Eitz Hadar, which tradition teaches us is the etrog, anaf, Eitz Avot, no, we don't get to there yet, kapot tamarim, a branch of a palm tree, and the anaf Eitz Avot, which is the myrtle, the hadas, and arve nachal, the willow of the river, the aravot. Those are the 4 species which we are commanded to take on the first day of Sukkot. The same verse that commands that, that gives us that mitzvah, the mitzvah of arba'a minim, also says, Usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokeichem, and you shall rejoice before your God, Shivat Yamim, for 7 days. The commentaries teach that there is a little bit of a contradiction in this verse, which has to be overcome, and it is, and that is that the question whether we're talking about the first day or all 7 days, if the topic is the Arba'a Minim, the Lulav Etrog Hadasim and Aravot, and the Torah is commanding us something related to the first day and something related to 7 days, we ask, which is it? And the answer is, every place outside the Beit HaMikdash, outside the Holy Temple, Lulav is required on the first day only. In the Beit HaMikdash itself, meaning the area of the Beit HaMikdash, and there's an opinion of Maimonides that it applies to all of original Jerusalem, but let's leave it at the temple now. There the mitzvah is all 7 days. So what do we do? Up till the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, we were taking Lulav and Etrog on the first day of Sukkot as commanded. After the destruction of the Second Temple, there was a decree. Actually, there were many decrees by the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, led by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who instituted various and sundry practices as commemorative of the Beit HaMikdash, the Temple. One of them was to take the Lulav and Etrog all 7 days of Sukkot wherever we live, not just in the temple. So the mitzvah of Sukkah all of a sudden went from being a one-day mitzvah, first day of Sukkot, to being, by rabbinic decree, the entire Chag. came the rabbis and they said, okay, little bit of a problem. On Shabbat during Sukkot, don't take the lulav and etrog. And the rationale that they gave for this decree was lest someone who lives in an area where you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat, meaning it's an area that is not properly enclosed by an Eruv, somebody might make the following faulty logic. He would say, mitzvah today to do lulav and etrog. My lulav and etrog is at home. I'm going to the Beit Knesset, to the shul, to the synagogue, to daven. So I will take the lulav and etrog with me. I know that I'm not allowed to carry on Shabbat in my particular town or city, but it's a mitzvah, so it must be that you're allowed to carry. Fact of the matter is, you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat in an un-eruved area, and our sages wanted to protect Shabbat in that ultimate way by saying, do not do the mitzvah of lulav and etrog on Shabbat, and this rule is across the board. In other words, people who live in Eruv areas where they're allowed to carry still don't do lulav and etrog on Shabbat. Great scholars who would never forget that you're not allowed to carry and would take precautions to bring the lulav to shul before Shabbat or whatever are bound by the same decree. It's a decree that goes across the board and it includes everybody. We don't take lulav and etrog on Shabbat during Sukkot, even though it is a requirement. Now, wait a minute. If we're talking about the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh day of Sukkot that coincide with Shabbat, one of those, then I can understand how the rabbis could say, take lulav and etrog the entire holiday, but not on Shabbat. But that's not the situation this year. This year, first day of Sukkot is Shabbat. First day of Sukkot, lulav and etrog, is not a rabbinic command. It is a biblical command. The Torah commands us to take the four species on the first day of Sukkot. The rabbis came along and said, don't touch it, leave it alone, do not fulfill that mitzvah today, meaning this Shabbat, because we decree that we want to prevent this inadvertent violation of Shabbat by someone who would ignorantly carry in a place where you're not allowed to carry in order to do the mitzvah. Do you follow that? The rabbi said, don't do that which the Torah said. Let's put it the other way. The Torah says, do it. The rabbi says, sit on your hands and don't touch it. This is technically mind-boggling. And it requires, I don't know if I'm even going to be able to convey the kind of answer that I would like to have for it, because it involves a something that's called emunat chachamim, a trust and faith in our sages that they have Torah authority to make a decree like that, and they in fact did so. Now we still have to look at something here, but let me interrupt for a moment. I would like to give you my AOL instant message what's it called, screen name, because this is a rare show that we're doing live, and if you're listening to this after the 5 to 6 hour of Thursday afternoon Israel time, then don't bother contacting me by AOL, unless you want to, but you won't be on the air. I mean, you won't be during the first recording of the show. If you want to communicate that way, and maybe I should always do that, it's not a bad idea even when it's regular recording, because then a listener feedback, oh, what am I talking about? that won't be able to get recorded unless it's done when I'm actually recording. So forget what I just said. Now, today only. It's a one-time offer for now. If anybody wants to contact me by instant messenger and interact to anything that I'm saying, ask a question, make a comment, I'll see if I could respond to it while we're still on the air. My screen name is Wasabi Phil, one word, Wasabi, which is not only that very potent condiment for sushi, it happens to be what my grandchildren call me, the ones that are able to speak so far, and there's a long story of how I got that name, but that's what I am called. Wasabi Phil is the name that most other people call me. So Wasabi Phil, Wasabiphil, is my screen name, and as they used to say on the old telethons, operators are standing by waiting to take your call. I'm standing by waiting to hear your instant message if you would like to give it. Let's get back to the thread that we had opened. We have a situation where we accept that our sages through the generations, especially and specifically at the time of a formal Sanhedrin, have the authority to actually tell us not to do something that is a command to do, if they have the proper reason, which they do. They cannot tell us to do something that the Torah says is forbidden. That far it doesn't go. But they do have the authority to forbid that which is a command of something to do. And they did it. But the second question, I think the more important question, is why did they decide to do it? They didn't have to. They could have said, on the Shabbat of Sukkot, especially when it's the first day, you have to be careful because there are areas that you're not allowed to carry, and this way you have to make sure you don't bring your lulav and etrog to shul in a through streets where carrying is forbidden. And that would have been done. They would have had a mass education plan and reminders, and we have plenty of reminders like this. They could have engineered it differently to allow us to do the mitzvah as the Torah commands us on the first day of Sukkot, but they didn't. They chose instead, and I believe it was a conscious effort, they chose instead to tell us not to. And that highlights in bright spotlight form an issue which I think I will share with you. We'll continue this, in other words, after the news update. But now, if our kind technician Ben will help out, let's listen to a little music until the news update, and we'll be back with more Torah Tidbits audio after the break.
יהודים מתכוננים ל...
שבס קוידש!
ססים ושמחים ב...
שבס קוידש!
יהודי רוצה להיות כהדושי ב...
שבס קוידש!
רוצה לקבל חלק בראשי ב...
שבס
קוידש! התנאים מהמוראים מיני מהטוב ומהנאים מבקשים להכין ל...
שבס
בשר ודגים ל...
שבס קוידש!
עם כל הכוח, עם כל המוח, שבס! שבס! גם הוא ננר מדליק רוב ודג מולע רב זיירה מדליק אש רב חיסטי קרוב קוצץ רב נחמן מי במים רב ספרה מנקר ראשו בהימה הכל לכובד שבס הכל בירה, הכל ביהבה והכל לכובד שבס Ay 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 Shabbos Kodesh Shabbos Kodesh Yehudim mitkonenim le
Shabbos Kodesh
Sasim u'shmechim be
Shabbos Kodesh
יהודי רוצה להיות קדוש, שייבה רוצה לקבל חלק בראש, שייבה איזה זכות, איזו התעלות, כל יהודי בהתפעלות תורח למען, ותחזח למען, מה עוד נשאר, הכל נגמר, שבת להכין את הנירות, להבריק הרצפות, ללחוץ הילדים, לשטוף את הכלים, להשחיז את הסכין, העיקר שיצא, הקוגל מוצלח, הכל לכבוד שבת. בינתיים זוז, נזוז מהמטבח, הכל לכבוד שבת. איזו התעלות, כל הגרת בית בהתפעלות, מה עוד לא ניסיתי לה, מה עוד לא הכנתי לה, מה עוד נשאר, הכל נגמר, שבת חלפת כבר, והמשקה קר, בעצמה בישלה, בעצמה הכינה, כך למדה מימלת, יהודי רוצה להיות קדוש, שבת רוצה לקבל חלק בראש, אי בשבת קודש, אי בשבת
of the beginning of the show and just now at the second part is from an album by Roman Kunzman, Zichrono Livracha, of blessed memory. He died a couple of years ago, very tragically, and he will be missed. The particular piece that I used for many years on this show, I've changed since then, but we're back to it for this show, is called Simcha, which is particularly appropriate for Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, which is the nickname of the holiday of Sukkot. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, and I will also try to remember to tell you a Roman Kunzman story, because it's very appropriate to Sukkot, and it makes a very important point. But we were talking before the break, actually for a while already, about the coincidence, although not coincidence, of Shabbat and the first day of Sukkot, when we do not fulfill the mitzvah of lulav and etrog. We do, of course, fulfill the mitzvah of dwelling in the sukkah. That's pure 7 days, day and night, 24 hours, seven, as they say. That's the original 24/7. And lulav and etrog is just daily, except that from the Torah it is only the first day, and by rabbinic decree since the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, it is all 7 days, minus the one day that is Shabbat, whichever day it is. Of particular significance is the fact that this year it's the first day that's Shabbat, and we might not have thought that a rabbinic decree could knock out, so to speak, a biblical command, but it does. I was just getting into why they went ahead and did it. First, you have to understand two other things, and that is, one, they have the authority to do what they did, and two, it's binding on us, that's part of one. And second, they could have chosen some other way to do it. They did not say, for example, no one is allowed to have hot food on Shabbat, lest one might make a mistake and think that it's okay to cook on Shabbat itself. No, instead, we are taught to cook the food before Shabbat, and we are told how to go about keeping it warm and even warming it up on Shabbat in a halachically acceptable manner. If the sages were afraid of inadvertent violation of the Shabbat, they might have made a decree saying no hot food on Shabbat. The Torah says no cooking or baking. The rabbis say, which they don't, but they could have said, no hot food. And that would have been a safety measure, which would have been within their purview to do, and yet they didn't do it. Instead, they chose to teach, which is always much harder, because you have to reach everybody on his own level, to teach how to go about avoiding the violations of Shabbat while you accomplish various and sundry results that you're looking for. For Sukkot, there would have been dozens of ways to suggest how you could take Lulav and Etrog even on Shabbat, but they didn't do that. They made a wide sweeping, across the board ban on the Arba Minim on Shabbat, period. The song that we played at the end of the first segment of the show contains the answer. It was a song about Kavod Shabbat, the respect for Shabbat. Now, you have to really look at a little bit bigger picture as to how Shabbat interacts with the holidays that fall on it. After all, Shabbat was there first. Shabbat is a result of God's creation of the world, and it came before the Egyptian experience and the Exodus, which created, so to speak, the cycle of the holidays. It is known as Rishon Hu Limikra'ei Kodesh. It is the first date to be called holy, and we read that in the Torah on the first day of Sukkot. So Shabbat takes a back seat in various ways, but is always there. And it's really always there very prominently. When you light candles for this Yom Tov, it's the same candles, the same number of candles, and the same method of lighting as Shabbat. And instead of just saying, Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbat, we say, Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbat, Veshel Yom Tov, which is different from saying, just Lahadlik Ner Shel Yom Tov. So let's call it, so far, a tie. When it comes to candle lighting, Shabbat and Yom Tov are both represented equally. Then you come to the Kabbalat Shabbat, the Shabbos welcoming prayers, abridged. Ashkenaz, Sfaradi each have their own ways of handling Kabbalat Shabbat. But the Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sfarad of the Ashkenazi Jewish community abridges, in one way or another, Kabbalat Shabbat when it coincides with Yom Tov. Now, you could say that that's a point for the Yom Tov over Shabbat, or you can say that Shabbat is being welcomed not only by this abridged version of Kabbalat Shabbat, but by the Yom Tov and its sanctity as well. Let's forget about going through the whole day. We'll never finish. The bottom line is Shabbat is holier than Yom Tov. No offense meant to the Chagim. But Shabbat trumps Yom Tov. Still doesn't explain why our sages chose to tell us not to take the four species. They said, in this case, we want Shabbat to come front and center and take another curtain call and another bow. And we want you all to realize that whatever purpose there is in the four species, Shabbat goes along with that purpose. Shabbat gives you that focus. If you look at it from the point of view of natural products, which is a Sukkah message as well as a Arba Minim message, connecting one to nature, the need for water. Fine. Shabbat represents creation of the world. So it carries the message, whatever message Lulav and Etrog are trying to get across, in its own essence. And I believe the rabbi said, here's our technical reason for banning Arba Minim on Shabbat, but the real reason has to do with the fact that we want you to recognize that whatever message you get out of the Arba Minim, that message comes to you from Shabbat also, which means on this particular day, you're not going to need to have that extra measure of the Arba Minim. It is not done on Shabbat, but it's not missing on Shabbat either, because Shabbat itself conveys that idea. Now, I said this stronger when it came to shofar. Shabbat was known, I believe, as the silent shofar. And here, it's the non-lulav and etrog, lulav and etrog. It's the same commitment to Torah and mitzvot that Shabbat says, don't forget that, the rabbis pointed to it, don't forget that Shabbat's supremacy is a message for the holiday season as well. It's not just a coincidence of the calendar. It's got to fall on some day, so it fell on Shabbat. No. In fact, what I'm saying, and I'll summarize it with this and then move on to something else, it is the fact that we don't have Shabbat and Yom Tov this Shabbat. We have something that's a hybrid called Shabbat Yom Tov, Shabbat Sukkot. It's a new being with its own identity, and part of that identity is the following of the rabbinic decree not to take the Arba Minim on Shabbat. I don't know if that made any sense to anybody, but that's how I feel about it, and I would ask our kind technician once more to put on a song which will ease us into the next topic, and that's the topic of Simcha.
Schine soire, loy mit doy khatzus. Di schine a kidoy shrut nisht, wenn mi ist roire. Elo mit doy simcho, shel bevar mi itzvo. Haye schine soire, loy mit doy khatzus. Di schine a kidoy shrut nisht, wenn mi ist roire. Elo mitoich simcho shel bevar mitzvo. Ayu mitzvo gedoilo liyoiz besimcho, liyoiz besimcho, besimcho tohomid. Mitzvot gedoilo, liyoyz besimcho, liyoyz besimcho, besimcho tohomich. Mitzvot gedoilo, liyoyz besimcho, liyoyz besimcho, besimcho tohomich. Mitzvot gedoilo, liyoyz besimcho, liyoyz besimcho, besimcho tohomich. Ay, mitzvot gedoilo, liyoyz besimcho, liyoyz besimcho tohomid. Ay, mitzvot gedoilo, liyoyz besimcho, liyoyz besimcho tohomich. Yo, it's the same for tomid. I mean, so you know what? אותו במי מצוות גדולו ליוי בשמחו ליוי בשמחו בשמחות במי מצוות גדולו ליוי בשמחו ליוי בשמחו תמי אני מצוות גדולו ליוי בשמחו ליוי בשמחו
Avraham Fried with Mitzvah Gedola Lehiyot Besimcha. It is a great mitzvah to be joyous all the time. Which is a little strange if you think about it, because the Torah says, V'samachta b'chagecha, you shall rejoice on your holidays. And that implies that Simcha belongs to the holidays, and not necessarily to every single day. The fact of the matter is, I would like to think of it as a diamond ring. The ring itself has a value. It's made of gold or platinum, whatever. And it is set with a diamond so that if you were to poetically look at the circle of the ring as the cycle of a person's year, let's say, then going around the ring, you have a valuable commodity all the time. Let's call it simcha. That's your mitzvah gedola lehiyot besimcha tamid. You go around that ring, around and around and around, and you are always, if you do it with your finger, you're always touching a precious thing. But when you get to the diamond, then you have a higher level of value and preciousness, or in this analogy, in simcha, and that's fine. We have this in a lot of things in Judaism, and another thing which is appropriate to what we're talking about. For example, remembering the Exodus. The Torah clearly states that there is a mitzvah to remember the Exodus from Egypt all the days of your life. When do we actually quote that statement? At the Seder table, on the night where it is the diamond in the ring of commemoration of the Exodus. What does that make of the rest of the time? The valuable gold or platinum ring that it's that the diamond is set in. In other words, every day there's a fulfillment of remembering the Exodus. It happens to be the daily, twice daily recitation of the Shema, which has its final verse acknowledging God as the one who took us out of Israel. We have it every out of Egypt. We have Freudian slip there. We have our weekly Kiddush on Friday night, which refers to Yetziat Mitzrayim. The Kiddush of Chag certainly does. The holidays themselves all do. Sukkot is another form of commemoration of the Exodus, like Pesach is. So it's an everyday thing that has special times as well. Now getting back to Simcha, and getting back to what I told you before, the Roman Kunzman story. Roman Kunzman was born and raised in Leningrad. Now, back to its old name of Petersburg, or St. Petersburg. He came to Israel in the early 70s, I believe, as a totally non-observant but Jewish individual, happened to have been a musician, a jazz musician, trained in classic music as well. And he came to Israel. He married an Israeli girl, and he started to live happily ever after, whatever that means. Somewhere around the time that he decided, they decided to go to the United States to live, he got a little bit interested in Judaism, but he was already prepared to leave, and he left. But because of that interest that had been sparked by a rabbi here in Israel, when he came to New York, he went through Rabbi Grunblatt in Queens, who handles a lot of Russian immigrants to the United States. And Rabbi Grunblatt called the rabbi of Shul where I was working in my community, and that rabbi called me to say that on Shabbat morning he was sending this Russian newly arrived in the United States to the shul that I davened in. Will I take him under my wing and teach him about things? We became fast friends. I won't go through the whole story now. And he and his wife and my wife and I, we all became friends. They used to babysit for us. I used to teach them a lot. And slowly but surely, it was more than slowly, very rapidly came to religious observance in a beautiful, beautiful way. Very enthusiastic. And it was a pleasure and almost too easy to teach. I met Roman in the summer, maybe summer 75-ish, something like that. And I don't remember exactly which summer, one of the summers. And first order of business was to prepare him for the upcoming Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, which come one right after the other, as you all know, and not so easy to prepare a person for. Taught him everything that I could think of, and 5 minutes before candle lighting on the eve of the first night of Sukkot, which would mean for us tomorrow night, 5 minutes before candle lighting, I was not in the community, I called him from my parents' home, and I said, "Look, Roman, I don't have time to explain, but if it continues raining like it's raining now," this was in New York, "you don't eat in the sukkah, you eat at home." He and his wife at the time were in high boots and rain slickers and rain hats, bundled up to brave the cold rain. They had all of their food in pots wrapped in towels on their way out to the community sukkah, where they would have found nobody there. And he was shocked that there should be such a thing as a mitzvah that you don't fulfill when it's not convenient. He was ready to make that dedicated commitment to eat in the sukkah at all costs, because that's the mitzvah. And that to him represented his newly acquired commitment to Torah. Very noble, very nice, but we're dealing with an unusual situation. And I said, "I can't explain it now, but as soon as Chag is over, Chol HaMoed, we'll get together and I'll explain it." And I don't know if it got across to him, and I don't know if it's going to get across to you, Torah Tidbits audio listeners, but this is the way it works. If the command of sukkah would be to eat in a sukkah, or to sit in a sukkah, or to be in a sukkah, then we would have to do that rain or shine. Just like a person can like the taste of matzah or not like the taste of matzah, he could fast well on Yom Kippur or dread the day because it's such a hardship to fast. Healthy person has to fast. When it comes to sukkah, what made it different is the command is not to eat, not to sit, not to be. The command is to live in the sukkah. The Gemara describes it as teshvu ke'ein taduru. You fulfill the mitzvah to sit in the sukkah by living in the sukkah. If it rained into your living room, you would not stay there, nor do you do it if it rains in your sukkah. There's loads more. It'll have to wait for another time. I have just enough time to wish you a Chag Sameach and a Shabbat Shalom. I should say Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach and L'Hishtameach.